Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never that debt is fraud. Let's remember, in the process of appealing to heaven, we need to learn and need to continue to understand those things, because the more we understand, the more we can actually articulate and actually act. Because remember, folks, knowledge is power, but it does not actually transition automatically into power. You must act upon that knowledge. That's when it is actualized into quote-unquote power. Also, I can't tell you, you know, I hear this all the time, how, you know, people should be continuing to do bad things regarding the country. I mean, I read a post yesterday by a gentleman that was saying, you know, Trump ought to just go and do things completely unconstitutional in fighting the courts. And I said, why does he have to do something unconstitutional? I forget what he was talking about, ignoring the courts or doing what he wanted or what have you. And I just said, why do that when actually he could make this world a much better place by retooling the Department of Justice, focusing them on going after every judge, every representative, everybody in public office, all the way down to local offices, counties, and so forth, who are violating their oath and failing to actually do their duty in supporting the Constitution, and instead of supporting these unconstitutional agendas. This would get rid of many governors. It would get rid of all sorts of people at the state level. Wow, are we ready for the consequences of holding people accountable? Because bottom line, yours truly has been asking since 2020, it came out. I was at a convention in Wyoming where a state senator pulled me to the side with a few other legislators, and they were all kind of concerned. And they said, GR, we love what you're doing, but you're asking us to hold us accountable to the Constitution when we don't understand the Constitution like you do. And we're afraid of losing our jobs. We're afraid of not being able to do good things. And I just smiled. I said, you don't have to do that. That's why we have this committee for the federal review. You create this committee, and now you'll actually have a source to go to say, is this constitutional? They become your, instead of using lawyers, you actually educate people on the facts. And everything that they have to assert must be grounded and based in the ratification debates. If it's not there, then it's not up for interpretation. It needs to go back to the states, the parties to the compact, or in the state constitution, the counties, which are the parties to the compact, and they need to actually provide some clarity in redefining, or not redefining, in ultimately defining what that clause truly means. You do that, and you are going to be nadir. You're going to be right on top of the object. You're going to be right on top of the problem every time. And there's people I know that understand my background, and they go, I just love when you get into the terms of the business, nadir, ephemeral, and so forth. But anyway, that being said, in retooling the Justice Department, in retooling we the people, in focusing on holding them accountable, quit fighting the problem that seems to be affecting you the most, because bottom line, that's what they want you to do. The thing you believe is the problem is really not the problem. I can't tell you how many times I see these memes, I hear comments and I hear commentaries, it's taxation, this is killing us. It is unconstitutional government that is killing us, because they are asking for all of that money because they're spending money on things they have no authority to do. You get your government into those enumerated objects at the federal level, state level, and county level, and you're going to find that they have a surplus. They don't need all of the mechanisms of taxation that they have today. Taxes would immediately go down. As a matter of fact, the tax on property within states should go away. Property tax on any kind of property where the state has this legitimate authority, because this is antithetical to a Republican form of government and a government that was created to protect life and private property. When government can tax your property to a point where they can take your property away, then they have just violated the one of the two primary objects of why we instituted government. You know, obviously, they're not taking your life, but they're taking your private property. They're supposed to be protecting it. So they need to create mechanisms, and they need to stay within these boundaries. Maybe we pay a little more on sales tax, or maybe we pay a little more into the excise taxes on the need of the objects delegated. But I'm going to tell you, get them to stop spending on all of these things that the federal government is forcing them to spend money on, and spending money on things that they want to do and they've been doing, like the DEI crap, the instituting bad curriculum into education, just being involved to the level they are in education. We need to take a stand in getting government held accountable to the objects delegated. Those are the things that they can govern us by legitimately. And if there's problems with those, we need to get rid of those objects, or we need to change and alter them. We do not need to abolish our government. We just need to get them into compliance, because the things that we have the problems with is not legitimate government. Ergo, they're just begging you to do the wrong thing because they get what they want. And what they want is actually to get away from the constitutions and be able to rule us to where we become their subjects and start going down this path of statism and so forth. Anyway. So that's why we need you to start understanding the petitions. And this is where I want to remind you that what we're talking about as we go through this history from the Tory Acts to today, we're going through Louisiana Purchase. And the only reason we're going through the Louisiana Purchase is because you'll find documents being cycled around. You'll even find a congressional record of 1967 where a bunch of Democrats get up and basically say all sorts of salacious lies and present an argument as if the 14th Amendment is illegitimate. Remember, folks, these are Democrats, and these guys were doing everything they could to basically attack the 14th Amendment from the day it was written by redefining it, getting the courts to redefine it. These people understood that the 14th Amendment was a game changer in holding government accountable. And actually, it was the one thing that forced Britain to get far more aggressive in its political actions in America by subverting us. Excuse me, because they did have the deep pockets. They have been spending, I'd love to see a real honest accounting of how much money Britain has spent from the beginning of 1763 to today in trying to control and manipulate America. Now, they're controlling and manipulating us to some degree. There are a lot of different hands of globalist efforts, whether that be, dare I say, the Zionists, dare I say, the corporations, dare I say, the judiciaries. These are all globalist strings that are manipulating America, and there's an overseeing plan that wants to destroy our Constitution. All things lead to that. As a matter of fact, I think I mentioned before, if you could back out to a real macro view and you see all these ruts that America is stuck in, all of these ruts may be meandering in all sorts of different directions, but ultimately, they all come together, they all merge at the same point of taking us off the cliff. So What are we going to do? We have to begin interposing. We have to begin using First Amendment petitions in holding our local government accountable. Folks, the fact that we instituted a government and failed to delegate powers to it, i.e. our county government, that has been the biggest mistake we've made. Because as we delegate power to the local government, understanding that this is our most precious government, because these are the people that live in our towns and communities, know what we're dealing with, and actually should have a better understanding of how to regulate us. And instead, we just allowed them without any controls. And then because we didn't delegate to them the power, because it's all about jealousies. Madison, and I'll have to say, even Hamilton used those terms. The jealousies of government. Excuse me. The jealousies of government from the encroachments of the subsidies, or I should say ancillary governments, the general governments, is where you actually have your protection. In other words, if you had county governments that actually had delegated constitutional powers, then when they would have created that state constitution, when that territory finally became a state, that state constitution would have included the line, powers not delegated to this state are reserved to the counties and the people respectively. Basically, they'd have a 10th Amendment leading the beginning of their constitution. That way, when they enumerate the powers to the state government, they understand exactly what they can do and what they can't do, instead of believing that the Republicans or the Democrats, is if they agree, if they've got a majority or whatever, they can do whatever they want. This is really, this is just proof of how illiterate, that's the best term, it's the best way to do this, because folks, we need a good slap in the face. We have become so illiterate regarding our Republican form of government and the true rule of law that we're in this situation. It's our fault, even though we didn't know it. It was actually our forefathers' 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 fault, however many generations, wherever you are in that tree, right? So we have to start getting it right. This is why we read the documents to you. This is why we kind of help you understand why these documents are critical. We prove that there's nothing there that is harmful in that 14th Amendment. We prove that there's nothing there in any of the amendments that are truly harmful. Anybody that's running around and saying the 17th Amendment is the boogeyman, they're only trying to invoke fear because they, too, do not understand the Constitution. The 17th Amendment did not take away the state suffrage. And we prove this. It's the same thing with the 16th Amendment taxing income. They only went after taxing income because they had already started. By this point in time, by the 1900s, our government had become so perverted that, shoot, unconstitutionally, they created persons or created corporations into persons. They didn't have the authority to do that. And the federal government has no authority to be involved in regulating corporations and or even commerce within a state. They are to play the, I'll just say, the traffic cop. They're basically to be the umpire, as they use that term in the notes, in Madison's notes during the Constitutional Convention. They use that term, that they were to be the umpire between the states. That's all. No, you can't do that. The Constitution doesn't allow that to happen. I.e., when California started creating emission controls and started saying, hey, you can't sell that kind of crap here, and the federal government enforced that, that was a direct violation of the Commerce Clause. Now, California cannot stop a state from selling what they want to in their state, but they can start creating a better product on their own. But they didn't want to do that. They wanted to use the brute force of government and assuming powers. Had we actually followed the constitutional processes, there would have either been an amendment to the Constitution creating the ability to regulate the environment instead of just assuming the power, or better yet, we the people and we the states would have actually engaged in true competition in creating better products. But instead, why is it that we went down this path? Because the petroleum industry and the the polluting factories that were making automobiles that were polluting. By this point in time, folks, I would challenge you to go look in the 1960s in some of the innovations of engines. And why was it that the corporations, or I should say the petroleum corporations, were buying up patents for engines that were far more economical, that were even alternative, not using petroleum? There was even a hydrogen engine that was actually, the patent for that was bought up. They don't want you running around on water. Why? Because how do they tax water when it falls from the sky? Folks, I could go on and on and on and on. We have to start taking control and getting government framed. And when we have problems, instead of allowing a government to assume powers, we need to tackle the problem so that we can actually get ourselves in the proper place properly, instead of letting these tyrants assume more and more problems. Because there's a book you really need to read. It's called From Crisis to Leviathan by Higgs. I will pull up the book when I go into break, because I'll actually give you the name. I think it's Robert Higgs. You know, I'm bad with names. But this is one of the beautiful books that actually helps you see how government allows a problem to persist and get out of hand, because they already have a solution and it's more government not fixing the problem. And it basically proves how government and corporations have been very efficient and effective in creating self-licking ice cream cones. Because that's what we got a world of that. Anyway, let me dive into the Louisiana Purchase. Now, we just finished Article 4 of the Louisiana Purchase. So for those who have been kind of reading along, now we get back into that with Article 5. Article 5 states, immediately after the ratification of the present treaty by the President of the United States, and in case that of the First Consuls shall have been previously obtained, the Commissary of the French Republic shall remit all military posts of New Orleans and other parts of the ceded territory to the Commissary or Commissaries named by the President to take possession. The troops, whether of France or Spain, who may be there, shall cease to occupy any military post from the time of taking possession, and shall be embarked as soon as possible in the course of 3 months after the ratification of this treaty. So, in other words, they talk about the ratification of the treaty by the President of the United States, but actually, he can't ratify it. Actually, he approves of it to submit to the Senate, and the Senate must ratify a treaty. But the just like a court case, folks, we need to start looking at these processes in a real paradigm that actually lays it out to how the process is supposed to work via the Constitution, i.e., when something is being presented, whether it be to the court or to the Senate as a treaty, something to become law. Now, the court doesn't have any power of creating law, but things that go into the court, there is a threshold that must be met, a standard that must be met before the court actually opens its doors and accepts that. The same thing with the treaty. Now, it's not that this treaty exceeded the boundaries of the Constitution. It didn't. But there are and have been treaties where the Senate has brought in, they don't have any bounds. In other words, they feel like they can address and ratify, if they choose, any treaty, regardless of whether they have the enumerated powers or not. Regardless, just what I just said, regardless of whether they have the enumerated powers or not. And so what this does and what this means is that I actually, when we dive into, and we're going to get into this, when we get into the this concept of these treaties and so forth. And so actually what I want to do is lay into exactly how George Nicholas actually viewed this. I've got about 4 minutes to go through, so let me actually dive into, finish this next article into, and when we come back, I'm going to give you that book, the name that you really should get that. And by the way, it comes in an audiobook form. As a matter of fact, folks, I love those people who actually use this radio show for your commuting, because that means you can kind of listen to the content. It's like an audiobook. We're reading these things to you, and then we're providing some commentary, challenging, questioning, and explaining. Now, you might be able to, and you should. You should actually examine what I am saying and how I am analyzing and examining this, because I could be wrong. I could be wrong. And I'll be happy to admit that. And when you can come back and say, wow, look, I think you missed this point. And I would be happy to say, yeah, you know what, you're right. But I welcome that, but there's just so few people that really want to go there. Unfortunately, we are too busy in our lives to actually have these types of dialogues and conversations. I seek that. As a matter of fact, I tried to seek that with the John Birch Society in the 2018 and so forth, but where we could sit down and actually go through the merits of these documents and what they were really saying, and getting people to actually come to, forgive the expression, come to Jesus on this and say, wow, this is exactly what they were saying. You're absolutely right. Or no, you're wrong. This is what, and allowing freedom of academic and discussion to actually play out so that we could all become equally informed and make the right decisions. But no, 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 no. We don't want you involved in our organization of how we're going to decide things. And that's how it's played. It's very autocratic. We decide on what we're going to do and what we're not going to do. So Article 6, the United States promise to execute such treaties and articles as may have been agreed between Spain and the tribes and nations of Indians until by mutual consent of the United States and the said tribes or nations, other suitable articles which shall be agreed upon. This is why I wanted to pause and not dive into the treaties per se, because this is where it says the United States promised to execute such treaties and articles as may have been agreed between Spain and the tribes and nations of Indians until by mutual consent of the United States and the said tribes or nations, other suitable articles shall have been agreed upon. The reality is this. The United States had no enumerations in meddling using treaties, per se, with Indians. Indians that lived within the boundaries of the United States or within the states themselves were matters of the states. The only thing that was regarding any direct relationship with Indians and the federal government were taxations, whether they were to be taxed or not. Now, the 14th Amendment changed that regarding citizenship, but they didn't still, and as a matter of fact, the corporations and so forth actually go away when Indians become U.S. citizens. I should say the taxation of Indians not taxed, because the only reason Indians were not taxed, or they weren't capable of being taxed, was because they were considered autonomous. With the 14th Amendment making all people under the jurisdiction of the United States, and every Indian or every Native American, I'll be politically correct because I'm not trying to be mean, every person that qualified as an indigenous person, because they were under the jurisdiction of the federal government within the territories and so forth, they were automatically made citizens, just like the slaves were, who were equally under that jurisdiction for apportionments and so forth. Now, there's people that could argue this, but bottom line, the 14th Amendment had a very broad brush of what they were trying to do. So they used a broad brush to basically go after the Dred Scott ruling that said they couldn't be blacks, but all people under the jurisdiction became it, and that included Indians. And so we'll be right back with what I promised you.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so as promised, I told you I'd give you a book by Robert Higgs. Actually, I'm going to point out four books by Robert Higgs that are worthy of getting, and I believe all four of these are available in an audiobook or audio form. The first one is Robert Higgs, Against Leviathan, Government Power and a Free Society. Robert Higgs, Crisis and Leviathan, Critical Episodes in the Growth of American Government. How they actually use a crisis to assume power and to grow government. Robert Higgs, Crisis and Liberty, the expansion of government power in American history. And then Robert Higgs, Depression, War, and Cold War, Challenging the Myths of Conflict and Prosperity. Now, he's an economist, so he takes a very pragmatic view of how government operates. Not that he understands how unconstitutional everything is and how, because of an illiterate people and illiterate, I'll just say, representatives, because when you really think about it, the representatives we have just are anybody that goes in. That's not a bunch of people that have lived a lifelong career and have grown up in a family. This is why the aristocracy was created amongst the lawyers and politicians who made a lifetime effort of obtaining control and perverting and subverting our constitutional republic. Therefore, when most people go in and they're being taught, these people are there as the teachers and the guides. If you actually... If you take time to read Plato's Republic, he talks about the four different roles society needs to obtain the full breadth of the statist ideology that Plato talks about, how the perfect state can be created. And so you have the revolution, where it's all done by the peasants, where they kill everybody, take control, and they create a communist government. And or when you look at it by those who have means, then they actually have the affluence, the education, and so forth, in manipulating and massaging societies to basically start to bend. It's kind of like the same thing that they do with wood in woodworking, by soaking it and bending and twisting to where they can actually change the structure and the the overall shape of wood to take on a completely unnatural shape. That's what the lawyers and politicians, corporations, and the bankers, all of these evil pockets in our society. And so we're all convinced that, you know, this idea of capitalism is a good thing. Actually, the framers thought interest and those types of things were abhorrent. But they did also think that a person that made an obligation, took a debt and failed to pay that, needed to actually punish, be punished, I should say. And they didn't like the idea of, you know, creating or paying interest. But they did understand that a person that had money and they used their money to basically help other people, they could make money off of that by charging interest. Even though it's identified as usury, it was already baked into English society before the founding of our colonies. So you see a broader view on interest, banking, and so forth. However, I believe that the pure form of a civil society is one that is not creating, or I just should say, I don't want to use the word exploiting, but exploits the needs of others so that they can make their riches by, you know, loaning money, bankers, because that's exactly what they do. It's not like they have any skill. They've just become and have inherited a pot of money that they can exploit other people so that they can make more and more and more and more. And so it becomes a very, for lack of a better term, incestuous when you start looking at how this has been handed down from one generation to the next. The same thing. I mean, the medical process, if you look at the Hippocratic Oath, this goes all the way back to the beginning of the first union in the world, because they clearly acknowledge in the original Hippocratic Oath how this knowledge would be only transferred to their children and those entrusted, to where the average layman wasn't to learn the arts of health. So anyway, the other thing I promised before I get back to the Louisiana Purchase is the citation regarding treaties. You got to remember that the Supremacy Clause qualifies the ability for treaties to be to actually come before the Senate. Remember, now we talked about courts and jurisdiction and standing. The federal court has no jurisdiction over anything that does not arise under the Constitution, unless it is something that has to deal with a foreign entity and the United States or a particular state and so forth. I mean, so the jurisdiction in Article 3, Section 2 is very specific. Therefore, before the courts can open their doors to a case arising within the Union that does not extend to something arising under the Constitution or within their very qualified jurisdiction, they have to basically say, hey, we don't have jurisdiction over this. And I'll give you a good case in point. Labor. There's a dispute over whether somebody is, you know, in a good working condition or not, or whether, you know, they're being harmed in their working condition or not. You got to remember that the Bill of Rights were not extensions of rights that the federal government was to protect. The federal government was to actually stay away from being involved in those things. They were further declaratory restrictive clauses added to the Constitution so that if somebody had a case where the federal government got involved in regulating the press, the court would say, hey, you exceeded your authority. You cannot regulate the press, i.e. the people, not the platforms, the people. Because we as a society redefined the press in every state to be the person publishing. Ergo, any person can write a book, any person can write an article, any person can actually be a journalist to report something that they've seen. And every state has these laws that say, and you will be held liable if what you're publishing is not truthful. Those types of sub-clauses that kind of say, okay, we believe in the freedom of the press, but you better be careful with what you publish. A platform is not the press. A platform is a place that allows people who write to take their articles to, and they publish them. Oh, well, because they're a corporate entity registered by the state and they're not actually writing the articles, they're a medium. When they actually take away an article or they rewrite somebody's article so that it fits the narrative, then what they have done is they've tampered with the freedom of the press. Platforms cannot, Facebook cannot tamper with what you publish. It's one thing for them to hold you liable, but it's another thing for them to regulate, censor, or those types of things. Therefore, when this is occurring on the platform, all it requires is basically a whistleblower to come up and say, hey, hold on here. I gave them an article to publish, and they basically scrubbed it. They wouldn't publish it. Now, they can make the argument that we don't have room on this, but if they've actually set a pattern where every time you've tried to write a pro-Second Amendment, a pro, you know, life instead of choice, you know, these pro-cases, and they constantly have a very specific narrative, then you've basically proven that they're using the platform as a propaganda stance. And so whether that you can actually prove that they've actually censored, that's one thing. And I believe that you once you can start connecting the dots, it's easy to basically extend. But the bottom line is states are required to actually regulate them because the rights of the people in printing their story and publishing it is, you know, it cannot be abridged. The mediums, they may hire people and basically hire them to do very specific things. If that's the case, then they're not the press, they're propaganda machines. And the state needs to label them as such and actually go after them as a profiteering corporation trying to propagate bad ideas, you know, and trying to drive agendas that would be actually in some ways insurrectionist. In other words, when you actually start convincing people that the right to bear arms or the right of freedom of choice or those types of things, because technically it's one thing to say something precious about life and that life must be preserved. But I hate to tell you this, that when we look at the adulteress, and I'm sorry for going down this rat hole, but I've dug myself into this. So when we look at the adulteress and the stoning, and basically Christ pointed out that there is a new age. It's called the age of repentance and forgiveness, that we are to have the freedom of sinning. Now, in a society, we can create laws. But in a true liberal society, people must learn for themselves and choose for themselves. So if you are on that extreme clear white, where there's no tint, no tone, not a speck of gray or black, then you believe that everybody must choose for themselves because they have to make their own decisions when we have the ability to compel people. Now, again, it doesn't mean that we don't have the ability to create laws. I think we cross a very thin line and we're skating on very thin ice when we actually start taking away the liberties of others. We have to actually get to a point where we obtain such a strong consensus, and the Constitution basically requires 3/4 for the laws to be changed. And I believe that that's what it really should be probably in the states, or maybe if you want a higher threshold, maybe instead of 75%, maybe you want 85%. I'm okay with having a higher threshold, but I'm not okay with unanimous because there needs to be a barrier that allows the minority to have protection. Folks, we're getting at that point right now where the minority are Christians. And if you're in favor of being able to create laws of, you know, such magnanimity, you know, of such a magnus, or actually, my tongue gets tied to the prodigious, let's use the word prodigious, to such a prodigious position, such as a great, huge position on society that you cannot do these things, then you need to have such a high consensus that everybody believes that that's wrong. Bottom line, an enlightened society is basically a well-educated and disciplined society where we all start accepting that certain behavior is repugnant to an enlightened society. But we have to get to that point. We've got to get enlightened again before we can all start realizing that, you know, the existence of pornography, the existence of these types of, you know, gateway sins, drugs, gambling, those types of things that are actually a debasement of society. They open doors to basically destroy society. So we have to get there. We can't just get there because we have really smart people that know better and they're going to just... That's the same thing as the communist ideology, where they have people that know better than you and they're going to make the decisions for you. It's two sides of the same coin when you start going down that side of the scale of liberty. The side of the white, or I should say the pure libertarian mind, is where everybody has the responsibility to learn for themselves and choose for themselves. So we have to get back to academic freedom. We have to get back to these open and honest discussions, open tables where we actually open the forum. You know, once you've actually come to the epiphany of where we need to be, then that's where we need to go. But back to this concept of treaties and the enumerations, because bottom line, when we're looking at a treaty and the court has this responsibility of actually establishing that they do actually have jurisdiction. See, folks, when the federal court comes to you and says, hey, you can't do this on your property. Oh, hold on here. You're dragging me into court over something about my property. Where do you have jurisdiction over what I do with my property? Or the state property, where they, you know, you got a forest and they've claimed that forest to be theirs. It's not enumerated. They don't have the authority to possess forests within states. They've just assumed it. So when the state is being pulled into court to say, hey, you can't do those things in that forest, or we've got a park over here, something that they don't, and you want to actually take these things back, and you start doing that, and they drag you into federal court, and you allow yourself to be tried in a federal court, you are submitting, you are surrendering your sovereignty to a court that has no jurisdiction. They have to prove jurisdiction. They can't just assume it, and that's what they have been doing. Now, when it comes to treaties, the Senate has been assuming jurisdiction over all things. When the UN treaty was before them, when Indian treaties were before them, in creating reservations and in creating these, you know, areas of land that could not become state land under some treaty or something like that, under the auspices that they have the authority. Remember, the operative word is under the auspices. They don't actually have that. They don't have that authority. Those are assumed auspices. Those are assumed authority. So this is what Nicholas said in the ratification debates when he was clarifying that supremacy clause of treaties made which under their authority, and I'll get into it right here. Have we not seen in America that treaties were violated, though they are in all countries considered as the supreme law of the land? Was it not therefore necessary to declare in explicit terms that they should be so here? How then is this Constitution on a different footing from the government of Britain? The worthy member says that they can make a treaty, the Senate, relinquishing our rights and inflicting punishments because all treaties are declared paramount to the Constitution and the laws of the states. An attentive consideration of this will show the committee that they can do no such thing. The provision of the sixth article, this is the supremacy clause, is that, quote, this Constitution and the laws of the United States which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land, close quote. They can by this make no treaty which shall be repugnant to the spirit of the Constitution or inconsistent with the delegated powers. The treaties they make must be under the authority of the United States to be within their province. It is sufficiently secured because it only declares that in pursuance of the powers given, they shall be the supreme law of the land, notwithstanding anything in the Constitution or laws of particular states. In other words, they have to be within those delegated objects. So when the UN treaty came in, and the intent behind that was for the United States to adjoin to a different government, a different polity, and to basically submit us to these laws and governance of this new polity. Well, does the federal government have that authority in the Constitution to be able to do that, to be able to form a international polity and then actually submit us to that? No, that is not delegated. So when we start looking at these treaties, we have to understand whether they are actually under the jurisdiction of the government, of the federal government, before the Senate can actually say, yeah, we're going to allow this treaty to move forward. They cannot strip us of our liberties. They cannot subjugate us to another state. Folks, I had this conversation with Michelle Bachman, right? You know, I'm bad with names. So now I have to go to another break to just go back and look. Former Congressman Bachman, and I believe she's the regent or the dean at the School of Regents in Minnesota. Anyway, we had this conversation. I explained these theories, these concepts to her. She goes, you know, you're absolutely right. And she said, she actually on air, I believe, offered, you know, why don't you come and teach? Because people need to understand the Constitution. Nobody understands the Constitution like this. That's only because we become illiterate. I'm not a genius. I think anybody that starts reading and starts understanding and looking at the Constitution as a limited power of attorney, you actually, boom, as soon as you see that, as soon as you see that this is very limited and defined, and those are the only things they can do, that changes how you think moving forward. And you start seeing that, oh, well, they don't have the authority to do this at the state. It's not in their Constitution. They don't have the authority at the federal level. It's not in the Constitution. You quickly start connecting the dots. This is not hard. And this makes it easier to start writing petitions and identifying where did you get the authority to do this? Because the whole point of this initial interposition of petitioning is to basically interpose upon this the whomever, state, county, federal, whomever is assuming something they have no authority to challenge the fact that they're doing something without the authority. This is called the rule of law. And we have a right, we have a responsibility, and even Madison built upon this. This is why we go through these documents. But that, all that being said, I'm pretty sure it's Michelle Bachman. But anyway, all that being said, let me dive into, because we just hit Article 6. And Article 6 basically said that they're going to create these treaties with Indians. Well, hold on. They don't have the ability to actually move forward with treaties with Indians. They may have the responsibility of agreeing upon within that treaty to honor their treaties, but they require an amendment to the Constitution to initiate their own treaties. Even though it may be put in there, they didn't have the authority for that one line to do. Which is why we have to cover, because of this one article, we have to cover the Thomas Jefferson Amendment to the Constitution to actually make this part of this treaty legitimate. Article 7, as it is reciprocally advantageous to the commerce of France and the United States to encourage the communication of both nations for a limited time in the country seated by the present treaty until general agreements relative to commerce of both nations may be agreed upon, it has been agreed between the contracting parties that the French ships coming directly from France or any of her colonies, loaded with the produce and manufactures of France and her said colonies, and the said ships of Spain coming directly from Spain or her colonies, loaded with the produce or manufactures of Spain or her colonies, shall be admitted during the space of 12 years in the port of New Orleans and in all other legal ports of entry within the ceded territory in the same manner as the ships of the United States coming directly from France or Spain or any other colonies without being subject to any other greater duty or merchandise or greater tonnage than paid by the citizens of the United States. So in other words, they had this 12-year protection that they wouldn't have to deal with tonnage duties at all. This gave them a trading agreement. So it became a financial incentive in addition to this cost of the $16 million, whatever it was. I think it was 10 and then added 5. So I think it's $15 million we paid. So in other words, France and Spain would have a long-term commercial advantage in addition to France's $15 million that they'll receive. So it was interesting because France had this long-term treaty with Spain that they couldn't just shake. But basically what they did was they created a sunset with all engagements with both of those parties to basically say after 12 years, this cooperation, this association will be dissolved. Okay, so during that space of time, I'm going to continue to the last part of this. During that space of time, above mentioned, no other nation shall have a right to the same privileges in the ports of the ceded territory. The 12 years shall commence 3 months after the exchange of ratifications, if it shall take in place or shall take place in France, or 3 months after it shall have been notified at Paris to the French government, if it shall take place in the United States. It is, however, well understood that the object of the above article is to favor the manufacturers, commerce, freight, and navigation of France and Spain so far as to relate the importations that the French and Spanish shall make in the said ports of the United States without any sort affecting the regulations that the United States may make concerning the exportation of the produce and merchandise of the United States or any right they may have to such regulations. Now, when we look at the Constitution, does the Constitution have a restriction placed upon the federal government regarding preferences? Well, actually, it does. And you find that preference right here in Article 1, Section 9, Subsection 6. No preference shall be given. Oops, well, we ran out of time. I'll get back to this because I'll bring this back up on Monday. That we'll actually start off with this preference that was established in this preceding article. And then we'll move on to the rest of the articles of the French treaty regarding the Louisiana Territory. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.